Hi, welcome to Head Start, the podcast for race directors and the business of putting on races. When doors start dropping off planes mid-air, or your favorite online retailer gets in touch to let you know your personal details may have been compromised, it's tempting to think you may have done a better job handling that crisis were you in their shoes. But how well prepared are you really to manage the many crises that can come up during the planning and delivery of your race? Anything from a late delivery of medals or an unfortunate slip-up on social media to a full-blown race cancellation. Well, that's what we're discussing today with my guest, PR pro Meg Treat of Treat Public Relations. Meg has been on the podcast before discussing DIY PR strategies for race directors, and in today's episode, she joins me once more to discuss crisis communications, that is, what you should and shouldn't do when a crisis hits. How early should you look to communicate the situation to your participants and stakeholders? How should you go about doing it? And is the much-revered total transparency approach your best bet out of a tricky spot? As will become apparent quite early in the discussion, crises come in all shapes and sizes, and sometimes managing even a seemingly small hiccup can quickly escalate into a, well, full-blown crisis. Which means today's episode could be a lot more relevant to you than you might first think. So stick around for a thought-provoking discussion. Before we get into this amazing episode, I'd like to give a quick shout-out to our amazing podcast sponsor, RunSignUp, race director's favorite all-in-one technology solution for endurance and fundraising events. More than 28,000 in-person, virtual, and hybrid events use RunSignUp's free and integrated solution to save time, grow their events, and raise more. And we'll be hearing a bit more from this great company a little later in the podcast. But now, let's dive into our discussion on crisis communications with PR pro Meg Treat. Meg, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me back, Panos. It's always nice to be here with you talking about the business of running events.
Well, absolutely. It's a great pleasure to have you back on. I've been following, obviously, since I think we last spoke more than a year ago. I checked when our episode went out, and that was December 2022. So it's been a while, but I've been eagerly following your trajectory in the industry. You've been busy with a few things, taking on some races, and you now have an online course out. Do you want to maybe tell our listeners, the ones that don't know who you are, a little bit about yourself, and also for the ones who do know who you are, what you've been up to all this time?
Sure thing. Hi, my name's Meg Treat. I'm an entrepreneur, an educator, and an accredited PR professional. I'm the owner of Treat Public Relations, which is the endurance industry's primary PR agency partner. We work with some of the largest and most storied running events here in the United States, helping them share the stories of their runners and increase their impact in their communities. I'm also alongside that main role of leading Treat PR and growing it, I am the president of the Orange County chapter of the Public Relations Society of America, and I also teach PR at the collegiate level. I'm a limited term lecturer at my alma mater, Purdue University. But, you know, overall, Panos, everything for me is about communications and about running and making sure that people feel empowered to share their story and be the main character of that story.
Absolutely. And I have to say that before we got connected and chatting about stuff, I had a very kind of like nebulous kind of like meh kind of idea about PR. And you're doing a great service to the PR science as an ambassador of that field. I think you're doing solid work, which is, you know, not necessarily something I would have necessarily before meeting you connected with the whole like PR world. But you know, like lots of great stuff. I've been following you on LinkedIn, the stuff you do with Boulderthon. You're involved with the Dave McGillivray Trust or something. Is it a
Foundation? Yeah, Dave McGillivray has his Finish Strong Foundation. We're really proud to work with Dave in a number of different ways. We support DIMSI's in-house communications team. I handle all of Dave's personal PR. And then I've been helping to not just lead communications, but kind of jumpstart some of the programming after Dave rebranded his foundation a couple of years ago. And we've been pushing forward on making sure that all those dollars are having a great impact on young people to help them move more, give more, and read more.
Yeah, indeed. Like really, really great work you're doing there. And also, of the many races you represent, Boldathon we had on the podcast, what a journey they've had. I mean, they've been growing by leaps and bounds. The kind of, you know, like, and also the innovation that's coming out of that race. It's really exciting to be involved with them, right?
It really is. You know, I think that we are very lucky that we work with both kind of the old guard of race directors and the new guard coming in. And, you know, from the legacy lessons that we can learn from longtime race directors who are legends in the industry, as well as the things that we can learn from new race directors like Phil, who are totally innovating and bringing their kind of millennial marketing mindsets to the industry, it's causing a lot of good positive change. And obviously for races like Boulderthon, lots of positive impact on their bottom line and their registration numbers.
Yeah, I mean, Phil, he does a great job, and he makes everything look so easy, right? I mean, he's one of those people that just everything looks so easy for him, like, you know, like growing a race into the thousands in a couple of years, and, you know, like doing all the great stuff he's achieved with the race. He just makes it, you know, like look so effortless alongside everything else he does.
I know. And I know behind the scenes, he's working his tail off, you know, not just as an RD, but as a runner, as a business owner of other businesses in the local Boulder area. And he brings such a calm and serene vibe to it that it does give that effortless look in front of all the hard work that he's doing behind the scenes.
Yeah, he's a great ambassador for our industry. And I strongly suggest people take a note and go back and listen to that Boulderthon episode. There's lots of really great tips in there from Phil, as well as our other Spotlight episodes, some great races in there. So last time we chatted, we had a very interesting discussion on PR in general as a tool that race directors might use to reach out to public media and extend the exposure they get for the race. We touched on lots of very practical tips on winning over earned media being the kind of stuff that, you know, like you earn, meaning, you know, like people take an interest in your race and they write about it kind of thing, as opposed to paying for it, which is really a great eye-opener in terms of the many things that people could be doing in reaching out to radio, to press, to online media, and getting more exposure for the race with some really practical tips. Today, we're going to be touching on crisis communications. And I should say, because we've been discussing this this topic for a while, and the first thing that at least crosses my mind when I think of crisis, it's like, you know, like earthquakes and floods and really, really big stuff. And of course, we're going to be touching on weather as it is and other things. But I think it's important in the context of today's episode to explore crisis in a broader context, because crisis these days take many, many different forms. My first question on this topic would be, what really constitutes a crisis? What would be your definition of a crisis? And also in terms of, maybe you're going to give us a few examples, because again, the things that come to mind for me are like, you know, like wildfires and comets coming down, raining from the sky, that kind of thing.
Yes. No, I think it's a great place to start. And coming into this conversation this morning, Panos, I was thinking about my own definition of crisis that I've kind of adopted over the years working in PR, but I decided that it was prudent and thoughtful to actually go back to my textbooks from when I was in my master's degree. We had a lot of focus on crisis communications, and I actually found two definitions from my textbook from some PR scholars and researchers that I think are interesting. The first is super simple, and I love this researcher Heath's focus on being concise. He says that crisis is risk manifested. It's risk come to life, right? It's the worst thing that you could imagine happening right in front of you in the present. Now, Seeger, Selnell, and Ulmer, other researchers, they have a longer-winded answer that I think arrives at the same endpoint. But, you know, it's a specific, unexpected, non-routine event or series of events that creates uncertainty and that either has a significant or even just a perceived threat to some goal that we're chasing, according to their definition. So at the end of the day, I think Heath has the right idea with keeping it concise. It's risk manifested. You know, in my work as a PR practitioner, the definition of public relations is creating mutually beneficial relationships. So that's everything that I'm trying to do in my work all day. So for me, when I boil risk and crisis down, for me, and when I'm talking to the RDs that I work with, I'm thinking about crisis in the space of it being a time when a relationship with a group of people or a person or another organization is at risk of changing when we don't want it to change. Something is up in the air. Something might be morphing into a new type of relationship when we wanted it to be another type. So that's where I really approach crisis, is a relationship is at risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you bring the relationship into it, because up until that point where you were discussing, you know, risk manifested and stuff, like what came to mind is just, it's a curveball, basically. It's an unexpected kind of like spanner in the works kind of thing. But of course, RAISE directors listening to this will of course know that, you know, their whole lives is full of curveballs and spanners, right? I mean, every single day is a curveball for a RAISE director, but it's that aspect of it that makes it a crisis, I guess. It's the public relations and the relationship with your audience aspect of it. It's the fact that other people will be affected from this. It's not like something happened on the course and, you know, there's yet another problem to solve. It's the fact that these crises that we'll be discussing are the kinds of events that require you to communicate with people about what's going on, right?
Totally. And I think it's important to, we call it public relations, but it's really public's relations. There's never just one public. So even thinking about too, that we're not just thinking about a relationship being at risk with our runners, our participants, but it could be that we have a relationship with our city at risk who issues our permits. It could be a sponsor relationship that now we're not going to have an investment that we thought we were going to have going into this next road racing year. You know, any of those stakeholder groups, volunteers, elites, we can think about a million different types of audiences, even our own internal teams, that a crisis could be causing our relationship with them to be at risk.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that social media and the way the world has changed over the last, you know, couple of decades, it's made crises more prominent or more visible for people? Because I seem to basically be seeing crises around every corner, and I seem to be seeing posts with races facing crises all the time. Is it a matter of more visibly allowing those to the surface these days through social media, or are we actually getting more crises, like events being hit with more stuff that they need to handle?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think overall, my initial thought is that there aren't that many more crises events happening any more often than they used to. But just as you mentioned, they just have more visibility, more eyeballs. With social media, 24-hour news cycle, everybody having a video camera and the ability to share their opinion from their phone, we just have more opportunities to see what crises are unfolding. They were probably happening at the original road races in the boom of the 70s, but now with technology added in, it just makes it easier for us to access the experiences that people are having. And I think that that's the other piece of it, is that because consumers, our participants, have an opportunity to not just compare their road racing experience to the main road race happening in their town, that's the biggest game there locally, because they can see a live stream of an ultra marathon that's taking place in Switzerland this morning, or they can read an online article about a race that happened in Texas when they live in Illinois. There's the ability for us to see all of the experiences and all of the items that are available to us. And so I think that it makes the game of comparison and the game of expectation setting a lot harder when you're not just being compared to the actions and the activities of your local event that, you know, somebody can interact with down the street, but they really can see what they might get if they went somewhere else. And so I think as a result, consumers are a lot more discerning. They're a lot more critical, and it's easier to play the comparison game, which is sometimes where these crises can unfold from. I think too, you know, the last thing that I'll say on whether or not there's more crisis or there's more unfolding, I think the other thing that's worth acknowledging is that we talk about in the PR classroom a lot that, you know, your relationship with your audiences don't exist in a vacuum. They're not just through an email in a tube, not affected by the world around us. And our world now is very turbulent. It is sometimes presenting us with unpredictable, unexpected situations and cultural changes. And so I think that when you are in the context of that space, trying to have a relationship with someone, it's an added element that makes it sometimes hard to control, and things can change more quickly because we're not just existing in a vacuum. We have this whole context of the present day world playing out around us as we're trying to have this conversation with the people that we care about.
Yeah, I get that point, actually. I mean, also the point about, you know, being a global world, and we tend to basically see a lot more of what's happening, and maybe we get the impression of this availability bias type thing, where, you know, like you think there's more crisis happening simply because you have a lot more visibility into what's happening around you. However, would you agree that something that struck me as you were talking there, that there is a particular type of crisis maybe these days that is very pernicious, actually, and very specific to the world we live in, around stepping on a mine in all this like culture war stuff that we have online? Like, I you know, there's been so many things that actually I can remember from races saying the wrong thing, not phrasing the, you know, like things greatly online, and then just, you know, having this whole tsunami of responses that you get sometimes when things get out of control with all these like politics and culture war stuff these days. I think that may be a very specific new cluster of crises that races have to deal with and navigate around.
Yeah, when I think about these particular types of crises, Panos, every single situation is very different depending on what particular issue we're talking about. But I think what is consistent across the board, whether it's this type of crisis or any other, is that we need to come in with this preparation, which I know we're going to talk about here later in the episode, that causes us to take a look at who our organization is as a brand, what our values are, what our principles are, and what we stand for and what we represent in our communities. Once we have an understanding of who we are, it's easier to understand how we want to react. Certainly, I think that especially in these spaces, there's so many opportunities for us to learn and listen. I think amidst a lot of the cultural shift going on right now, there has been an uncovering of information that we have either inherently known and chosen not to really acknowledge, or that we're hearing about for the first time. And I think that, you know, taking that opportunity to educate ourselves before we react is helpful. Taking the opportunity to listen before we react is helpful. And again, understanding that we're a community event that brings people together, that's trying to have a positive impact in the community. I think that we also need to make room to make mistakes. I think that, you know, if we get obsessed with getting it exactly right in this type of crisis or in any other one, you know, done is better than perfect. And I think that there is some element of it where we can't learn what we need to learn unless we take the next step and gather more information. So I think that there's a lot to these crises that comes with the hesitation around not saying something because you want to say it exactly right, when maybe it's more about taking an opportunity to be curious and ask questions and learn in that moment rather than showing that you are already a perfect shining light of being able to say exactly the right thing. It's okay to be human and it's okay to level with your audiences, which I know we'll talk more about here soon.
These types of crises are an interesting example in another sense, which sort of leads me to my next question, because they're the kind of crises that catch people by surprise, right? I mean, again, I'm thinking, just for people to visualize, because I think it's interesting to look at the framework of crisis management through an example. You know, again, you put out the wrong comment, you say something the wrong way, or in a way that your audience may perceive to be the wrong way, right? And it's so difficult these days, sometimes, to roll back from that position. And then I wonder, which is a general question around crisis more generally, is do we sometimes, by acknowledging the audience's maybe merited complaints about things, maybe hysteria in some cases, are we bringing crisis onto ourselves? Are we basically making crisis out of nothing in some cases?
Yeah. This is an interesting one to think about, because to me, I think that we, even with crises that are in the news right now that aren't even related to running, I think about this Boeing plane situation with the Alaska Airlines flight, right? And when you look at a crisis, it's very rare that you look at the root cause and there's not something clearly there. I think that, you know, it didn't come back that it was a freak accident. It came back that some bolts were loose, right? There was somebody along the way who didn't do what they needed to do, who didn't check what they needed to check, or created a culture or an environment where they didn't feel they had time to check it. You know, there's a million things that we can think about, but I think in many cases, in terms of the idea of us bringing crisis onto ourselves, it is true that there's usually something along the way that happened, a breakdown in our systems and our processes and procedures, or in someone else's who we rely on in the space of our race that create the opportunity. And that's why it's important to think about, you know, reviewing all of these things ahead of race day to see what risks are there, what can be mitigated. But in terms of whether or not something is big enough to acknowledge, whether we need to get on top of a crisis before it's even fully materialized, I sort of have this Jiminy Cricket, let your conscience be your guide sort of take on it, that if you get that funky feeling in the pit of your stomach that makes you go, maybe we should tell the runners about this, or maybe we need to say something. You probably do. You probably have some inherent intuition. And I think you just have to put yourself in your audience's shoes and say, if this were me and I found out later that, you know, an event didn't tell me about something that happened, would I be upset? What would be my own reaction to this situation? And so it's true, there might be little hiccups along the way that, you know, happen behind the scenes that end up working out just fine. But I think in general, we have to think about managing expectations. And so if there is a potential crisis looming, it may be wise to help edit expectations for those different audiences so that they can be prepared in the event that it happens. And so that they feel like they were clued in, that they had buy-in, and that they had a role in their race day experience.
For a previous generation of leaders, the recommended course of advice in a crisis was to say nothing, right? I remember for decades growing up, and the standard response was just no comment. I guess you're saying we've moved on from that in terms of like our general thinking around crisis communications.
Yes. I think that we have completely moved on from that. Our audiences expect more from us. when I think back to my undergrad days, the first day of PR 101, this is actually what they address, that no comment is never a sufficient answer. I think that in general, there may be times when it's not helpful for us to comment. You know, say somebody calls you up to ask about what you think about an action that another race took. You know, is your comment, is your opinion going to be helpful in this situation, or is it just going to stir the pot? Is certainly a consideration to make. But I do think that in general, audiences now are expecting transparency. They are interested in communicating with brands. It's why things like social media have taken off. It's given them access to our organizations and to the people in our space way more than they've had before. And they like it. They enjoy it. It's why there's such high usership, you know, on these types of apps and platforms. But I think that in general, they enjoy the access and they're expecting to have that kind of open line of communication. We want, instead of being broadcasters who just speak to our audiences and then shut off, we want it to be a two-way conversation. That's the most ideal framework for any type of relationship that we have. And it's one that creates power and space on both sides of the conversation.
And I guess the whole no comment thing can also invite speculation, right? I think I was reading an article towards the end of last year. Was it Scotland or Wales or somewhere around there? There was an organizer who basically had a track record of canceling races and not issuing refunds and stuff. And, you know, the press got onto it. I really don't know the circumstances. Maybe, you know, it's all totally legit and stuff. But the whole point that that guy didn't come forward to comment on it, I guess it doesn't reflect very, very well on him, right? I mean, it allows that space for your audience to start thinking there's something fishy here. Like, why would he not comment? Why would he not come forward and say, you know, no, we had a legitimate reason for canceling, etc. It doesn't sound in this day and age the right strategy for at least this reason alone.
Absolutely. I think that the potential for speculation is one of the greatest reasons to put a crisis communications plan together. Not only because honesty and transparency are the best policy when we're talking about any type of relationship, right? Whether it's between us and our runners, or it's between you and a friend or a family member, that honesty and that transparency go a long way with building trust. And I think that, you know, in terms of this particular example, which I think is a great one for this particular topic, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And when there's someone hiding from the press, there's usually something to hide. So I think that it's, you know, a very fair assessment that folks have speculated on why that would be happening. And without an answer to the question, this is the other reason that we address the specific questions that we do when we make a comment on a crisis, is because we're trying to reduce the amount of questions that remain. A crisis is over when all the questions have been answered. And you'll notice that with any type of news story too. It's always in the news and continues to be in the news until all the questions are answered. When there's still speculation, that's when it's going to keep being a part of the zeitgeist, a part of the conversation. So I think that that's something to consider too, is how can you have answers to and anticipate all of the questions that you're going to get about a crisis situation, so that once you've answered them, it's kind of over. You know, all of that speculation and that uncertainty goes away. People feel good about what they heard, and as a result, they can move on. They have the closure that they need to move forward from the crisis.
Well, you mentioned earlier that it pays to get ahead of a crisis and basically, you know, be proactive, get out there and start communicating about things as soon as you possibly can. I'm wondering, where exactly should that line be drawn, and how soon is soon enough or late enough? And in the context, for instance, of the kind of crisis that many people faced towards the end of the pandemic, with world logistics being a total mess, I knew lots of people got caught out by not having medals on time, not having shirts on time, like facing all kinds of disruptions in the race. And, you know, race directors obviously receive information or should receive information from factories, from suppliers about this kind of thing being imminent. At what point would be the right point to start communicating about these things that could potentially develop into a crisis? You know, let's say your supplier brings you and they say, you know, there's a good chance that we may miss race day for some of your medals, or there's a good chance that some of our t-shirt stock may not be in on time. When you get that message, should your approach be to just get out there and communicate fully transparently about the whole thing, or thinking that this may blow over or in somehow maybe fix down the line, you should think, oh, you know, like maybe I'll wait it out for another few weeks, see how the situation develops. How early should you be stepping forward and communicating all that?
Yes, I'm going to give the standard marketer's answer that it depends, of course. But I think that in general, when we think about an issue popping up, even one like this that somebody listening to the podcast might be saying, are my medals not arriving on time really a crisis? Potentially, if you're going to have a ton of folks in your email inbox the day after the race saying, I can't believe I didn't have a medal. I didn't get the experience I wanted. You're awful. I hated this. I'll never run your race again. Then yeah, it's a crisis. We've got a relationship at stake, right? And I think a big bucket of crises that I recommend that clients prepare for are these ones that are related to the participant experience. If the course is changing, if medals aren't arriving, if there's not going to be an availability for fuel at some place on the course, anything that they were expecting to get, expecting to have be a part of their race day experience, if it's possible that that's going to change, the earlier that you can manage their expectations, the better. I think that in this particular case, there's nothing wrong with going ahead and communicating it as soon as possible. You know, when I think about the potential of folks coming back to you and saying, well, my medal is going to be late, so I want a refund, or I'm not even going to run. That seems like a pretty low risk for this, right? Instead, what they're probably going to feel is, wow, it was so nice of you to be transparent about this. I will keep this in mind. And even all crises are an opportunity, right? As much as they might feel like only a threat, they're an opportunity. I'm even thinking about, does this give you an opportunity to show your creativity and show your dedication to your runners? So your medals are arriving late. Can the supplier give you one or five of those medals, even if they can't deliver all of them, and you can have a photo op ready for runners at the finish line? So even if they're going to be getting their own medal in the mail, they're still going to have a photo to share on Medal Monday. You know, when we really think about like creating the fun runner experience, is there some creative way to take this, you know, bummer thing that's happening and potentially turn it into a great opportunity to show your runners that you care? So, you know, I think that communicating early typically creates trust because it helps manage expectations. It makes people feel like you were being conscientious of them and keeping them in mind all the while. So even something as small as a medal or a t-shirt delay can be a chance for you to create that buy-in and that trust with your participant.
And is that the case? Would that still be the advice for communication, even in the types of crises where the crisis may have been resolved or maybe no one has actually materially been affected? Because, you know, I'm thinking about these emails I get from time to time, hopefully not too often, where you get, you know, like one of the sites you're registered in maybe has a data leak or a hack or something, but something not that affects, not serious data being stolen or compromised. But, you know, they send this email around that says, on July 7th, someone accessed the site. We believe your account may be affected, but they only got through to, you know, this or that information, or even they didn't get anything. We just had an unauthorized access kind of thing. So this is the kind of thing that happens. There's no actual impact on people, yet still they communicate. Actually, I'm probably thinking that in their case, it's mandated by law that they should. But is that the kind of attitude you would take more generally, that even in crisis where no one was really affected significantly, you'd still go out and be upfront about things?
I think so. Because for me, in that type of example, I think about how in a crisis, it's important to appeal to and design our communication to appeal to the person who's going to be the most upset or the most unsettled by what we're sharing with them. Because say for you or I, maybe we've never experienced a serious issue with our data being compromised and having our identity stolen. But what if Susie, who registered for our race, she just got done cleaning up a mess that she's been working on for years, where a simple data breach caused somebody to take out a credit card in her name and run up tons of charges, and it screwed up her whole credit. And maybe now she can't buy a house. It's really hurt her day-to-day life. And now, even if we know that we weren't storing credit card information, if we didn't have any hyper serious information as a part of our registration process, Susie's still seeing that email when it comes through, or hearing about it secondhand, like, well, you know, the race had a data breach, right? That maybe they didn't communicate out. And suddenly she's sweating. She's going, oh, I just had a nightmare situation like this happened to me because of something like this. And so I think we have to think about, yes, maybe our average participant isn't super impacted. Maybe it's not worrisome to them. But based on the unique experiences of each participant, there may be one or a handful of people who feel very strongly or have an experience with this that it really brings up a traumatizing or tough situation for them. So I think we have to think about the worst case scenario, even if it feels like it's not worst case, because for someone, it might feel that way. And I think that in general, the reason that somebody knows that it wasn't that big of a deal or that it got resolved is because we communicated with them. If we don't tell them and they hear it secondhand, it's just like hearing that a friend talked behind your back secondhand, right? Instead of saying it to your face, it just hurts. It feels better to level with people and be transparent. It just feels better at the end of the day. So I think that, you know, not only is that part of it, but also too, again, another opportunity, even if a crisis resolved itself, take the chance to share with your runners how you mitigated it, right? How you were keeping them in mind and made decisions and thought quickly about how to resolve it. There's no shame in tooting your own horn when there was something going wonky and you were able to bring it back to a place where it's not going to impact them. And now you get to share that message as a part of your communications.
So you've got a great thing going. You've built a great event that people love from the ground up, and you're ready to take it to the next level. But is your technology up to it? If you've been hacking your way so far, using different tools for different jobs, having a so-so website, and spending hours moving data back and forth from your registration platform to your email marketing provider and so on, it's time you upgraded your tech before you look into upgrading your race. With Run Signups all-in-one technology solution, you'll get all the tools you need and more all in one place to help you build a solid foundation that will help support your race's growth for years to come. Free email marketing, an awesome free custom website, a fully customizable registration experience, and awesome fundraising and participant-to-participant referral tools are just some of the things you'll be getting when you join Run Signups' industry-leading platform. With that, you'll get the resources and support you need to get you through the next stages of your growth journey, and an amazing suite of race day tools to help you deliver a world-class race day experience to your participants and fans. So, To learn more about RunSignup's market-leading technology used by over 28,000 in-person, virtual, and hybrid events, and to book a free demo tailored to your needs, make sure to visit runsignup.com today. That's runsignup.com. And see what RunSignup's awesome race technology can do to take your event to the next level. Okay, now let's get back to the episode. The greatest, probably the greatest shared crisis of our generation as professionals has been COVID, of course, where lots of races had to be cancelled. And races, of course, still get cancelled on account of weather. But COVID was a specific crisis where, even in contrast to the medals example, you know, someone may complain, you know, you should have chosen a better supplier, you should have ordered earlier, whatever. It's COVID was something that just caught people by surprise. There was nothing you could do. And there were tons of people who had a no refunds policy, which, you know, runners were very happy to sign up to because there were very rarely cancellations before COVID, right? And then it comes to it and COVID comes around and you need to cancel your event and you need to communicate this to people. And of course, it's all fine, however difficult it might be to the communicating bit. There's also the who pays for it bit now with the refunds, right? So for something like this, with COVID, or I guess in the future with weather-related cancellations, that's completely outside your control. How far should you go to be the good guy in all this and basically take the hit instead of the participant? It's not your fault. It's not the participant's fault, but someone has to pay for this, right? And even if you have a no refunds policy, what would be your recommended communication and stance around that when it comes to that? Because someone needs to swallow the loss in all this.
Totally. When you have an event cancellation related to safety at the end of the day, whether it's a global pandemic, a weather-related emergency, a bridge falls down the day before your race, whatever it might be, you're going to catch flack no matter what. And that's something that you're going to have to manage your own expectations about and accept. There are going to be some people who say, no, I'm happy to run in a lightning storm and I would like to run. I can't believe you took this away from me. And there are others who are going to say, thank you for keeping runner safety in mind. I appreciate you. I think you did the right thing. There's going to be both. You're going to catch flack and you're going to catch compliments no matter what decision you make, going forward with it or canceling. The important thing is that you need to make a decision. You've got to listen to your own Jiminy Cricket conscience and find a way for you to sleep at night knowing that you did what you thought was best for your participant, who, of course, as event organizers, is our primary concern, the safety and health of our participant. If they don't arrive at the finish line healthy and safe, what was it for, right? So I think that you've got to make a decision that you're going to feel confident about regardless of what somebody might post in a Facebook comment or send you in your info at email. You have to make a decision that you feel good about and that you're going to be able to sleep at night knowing that you made, number one. As far as the financial element, I think that this is going to be different for every race. And I think that it's going to be different depending on every single situation. But I would say that more important than that is planning ahead of time how you're communicating your refund policy, how you're sharing that with your runners and making it something that they're highly aware of going into the situation. Again, managing expectations, right? Do you send out an email once or twice during the lead up to race day that reminds them about this fact? Where do you put it on your website? Do you bury it in the FAQ page in really tiny print at the bottom? Or do you make sure that folks are aware of it and know about it? I think that, you know, we have those types of policies to protect us as event organizers. I mean, even in my own contracts, I have my own policies that help me in my relationship with my clients and that are there to protect them too. So I think that in general, we have to be transparent and open about what those policies are. And rather than skirting around it and saying, well, I don't want to bring up the refund policy because I don't want to worry my participant about whether or not they're going to need it. Or maybe they're going to think I'm a bad person because I don't have the ability to give everybody a refund. You got to get over that part. You've got to get over that part and be transparent and also give yourself some credit. As an event organizer, think about how much you have spent going up to race day that you're not going to recoup the costs until after race day, right? And, you know, our participants don't necessarily always know the intricacies that go into planning an event. And that's okay. They don't need to know exactly how the sausage gets made. But I do think that there's part of it that we have to look closely at our own policies and how well we're sharing them with our runners so that when those things do come up, the runner isn't sitting there going, I didn't know you had a no refund policy. I never saw that anywhere. You want them to go, oh, I guess I did see that. That's a bummer. Now, if you have the ability to offer a discount on next year's race, let people defer. You know, amazing if you have the room to do that. Should you feel obligated to completely throw your financial health out the window as an organizer or as an organization that puts on races just to do this? Should you have to die by your own sword? Not necessarily. Again, that's why you have the policy there. It's really about making sure that you know what your policy is ahead of time, that you're putting it out there effectively, and that if you had to ask random runners on race day, hey, do you happen to know, and I'm not suggesting that you do this, but you know, if you took a sample of people on race day and say, hey, are you aware of what this race's refund policy is? Hopefully some of them know it because they were educated about how that works. Not just that, about how gear check works and where to do it, about whether or not they can have somebody pace them on the course, any of the other policies and rules that we put in place. If we don't share them, then they can't help us. They're there to help us.
Well, in this particular case, when you're actually sitting down to write that email, you know, let's say, let's forget about COVID. Let's look forward. You know, there's a wildfire or a thunderstorm, as you say. When you're sitting down to write that email to participants, question one, what information sort of would you put in that email? So what kind of information should that email contain? And going back to the refund policy, obviously you might want to mention that we have a no refunds policy. Would you feel the need in an email like that to defend your no refunds policy by, you know, making all the arguments that race directors legitimately make around sunk costs and expenses being paid and all of that kind of stuff? Or would that seem too defensive at that stage? Like, what would you choose or advise people to do?
Before we even start crafting the message, there's a piece of crisis communications planning that's just taking a hard look at the way our organization works and figuring out what the risks are. For example, do we have a refunds policy and where do we put it? Where do people see it? But this could be anything, right? It could be what type of medical staff do we have in the event that somebody has a medical emergency? Where are they along the course? It's just that situational analysis of any type of risk that your event might have that can be mitigated. What steps are you already taking to lower that risk? And then what else can you do before you even write these statements or before they even occur to even further solidify your plan and make you feel confident that your risk is as low as it can be? Then after we do that planning, after we do that preparation of figuring out where are our weaknesses and where can we make them our strengths, whenever we're creating a crisis communication statement or when we're making an entire comprehensive plan that goes through all of the different events that can occur, there are four questions that we want to break down as a part of our crisis communications statement. Whether that's appearing in an email or it's at a press conference or it's an email to a media member or it's a post on social media. The first is, what happened? What actually has occurred here? The best way to approach it is from a chronological standpoint. If you can tell the narrative story based on time of what all went down that led to this happening, this includes when you became aware of it, what you started to do, etc., in a reaction to it. The next one is, what do we believe was the reason that this happened? Is there currently a root cause that we can identify? If there's not, we don't want to speculate, but we do want to remind people that we're looking for the root cause and what the plan is for updating them once we've investigated what it might be. When's a time they can expect to hear from us again, even if we don't have a completely clear answer yet? We want to talk about, too, what did we do? And this is the part of that crisis planning situational analysis that's important, is what did we do before this to try and keep it from happening? Basically showcasing that we were on top of it. We did try to mitigate this risk, and this was what was in place. Now, if you didn't do anything, of course, you can't lie in this situation. If you didn't do any preparation, or if there was no way to prepare for a global pandemic, it's okay to say that. You know, it's okay to acknowledge and level with your audiences. The last piece that's so important is what you're going to do moving forward to make sure it never happens again. And that's a promise. That's an investment of your time always moving forward, of mitigating this issue, because even when a crisis is complete, we have to tend to it going forward to make sure that it doesn't occur again. But talking about the true action steps that you're planning on taking to ensure that it's not a second occurrence coming down the line is going to be an important piece of the puzzle. I think that amid all of these questions, the other thing that's important to do, as I've mentioned, is just level with people, being honest with people, you know, sharing in them being bummed out or this not being an ideal situation. You don't have to pretend that everything's okay in a crisis. It's okay to be amongst the people and say, I get it. I get that this is not ideal.
And definitely, I'm guessing in all this, it's all implicit. Definitely do not be dishonest with your answers, right? I was digging up, I'm saying this because I was digging up this case. We actually wrote about it in our blog on race cancellation, about a race back in 2014, which got canceled in Colorado. And then in the response to that, the race director said, you know, oh, it was because of some floods. And then subsequently, you know, people dug into it and they realized that it was actually because the local authorities had denied the race a permit. And you're trying to basically communicate to put out a fire, and then your own communication, you know, turns that fire into, like, you know, something completely different. So definitely be honest with your communication.
Totally. There's no room for any type of lying or dishonesty in a crisis situation. And I think, too, it's also interesting to bring up that even though, you know, this race director didn't necessarily blame another organization, they blamed another contextual thing that had been happening in the area. Playing the blame game usually isn't helpful either. I mean, it's true. If there is somebody that caused it to happen, you know, certainly you don't have to take all of the blame. But pointing fingers and saying, I did nothing, it's all their fault. There's a way to take ownership collectively that I think, you know, while nuanced, is important. You know, for example, like the medals example that we've been talking about, right? Maybe you're not going to call out exactly the metal company's name when you're pushing out an email to your folks. You can say, we received information from our metal source that they are not going to be able to deliver on time. That's a better one than the evil people over there at Metals USA told us that we were going to get this and they didn't. And that's why you are going to have a bad race. You know, there's presenting the factual information and being thoughtful enough to not necessarily name names when it's not helpful and it's not important to do. And then there's being someone who's lashing out and being defensive in a way that's not productive, right? So I think that that's part of it too. And then, you know, especially with this race director who kind of like did all this work to find another excuse or someone else or something else to pin it on, it makes me think of, like, you know, in the time that it would take for you to come up with a grand plan to cheat on a test and come up with the way that you're going to write the answers on your arm, or you're going to have a paper folded up in your pocket or whatever it is, you could have just in the same amount of time studied for the test and gotten a better grade, right? So I think that there's also something to this too, that rather than spending your time trying to find somebody to blame or trying to find an excuse, you could spend the same amount of time coming up with a thoughtful and honest answer that's going to get you a better result, when you're actually going to have to end up spending more time, as you mentioned, cleaning up the mess of, well, I lied to you, and now I have to come up with an excuse about why I lied to you. And it's going to cost you double the time, double the energy, and double of the impact on the relationships that you had in a negative way.
Yeah, I guess I don't want to be making excuses for people, but I think when you come to that point, it's just, I guess, human to be weak sometimes and, you know, try to take some of the burden of the responsibility off your shoulders and onto someone else. I'm only saying that, you know, like lots of people don't actually, in these cases, maliciously set out to fool others. It's just that maybe they fail their better standards in that situation and they end up with something that's, you know, a little bit watered down or maybe not as gracious as it should be, or maybe, you know, points the finger to someone that it shouldn't. So it's a difficult situation for everyone. That's why we call it a crisis. So you need to sort of step up, right? I mean, that's the whole leadership aspect of it.
Yes, leadership was the exact word that I had in mind while you were sharing that thought, Panos. And I think that that's the thing. If you are stepping into a leadership role, you have to be prepared to handle these types of situations with a little more grace, a little more tact than your average person, say, getting a bad experience in a fast food store today might, where they lash out at the cashier. But, you know, I think that for me, I'm always looking at it where it is tough. I have to ask my clients to be the best versions of themselves as often as possible, right? And I think that when it comes to a crisis, the other reason that people will lash out, play the blame game, or fall into some of these traps that will make them feel worse on the other end is because they didn't plan. If you're thinking about a crisis for the first time while it's happening, of course you're going to lash out. Of course you're going to make decisions that don't feel good later because you made them out of fear instead of out of compassion or whatever value you choose as kind of your guiding value in a crisis situation. You know, decisions made out of fear often create problems. And so we have to put ourselves in a situation where we've planned ahead of time so that when it happens, we can go, ah, it happened. Take a deep breath and go, I'm so glad that I already wrote up all the action steps that I would take if this would happen, who I would call if this happened, and what types of information I would share if this happened. Because now I can think clearly, I can think calmly, and I'm not going to end up making a decision based on fear. I'm going to make it based on the values and principles that my race stands for as a brand.
Well, let's talk about that plan because we've been sort of tiptoeing around it for a while. What you were describing earlier, which is the whole, what risk might I face? What's the mitigant kind of thing? At least from a UK and European races point of view, which I'm a little bit more familiar with sort of the nitty gritty of it, it's your standard risk assessment plan, probably in the US has a slightly different name, right? So it's something that every race director, in many countries, it's mandated to have one. Local authorities expect you to have one. And any decent race director will have one that takes exactly this kind of like high-level form, which is, you know, what risk could I be facing? What might I do about this? You're talking about a slightly different thing, are you, with this crisis communications plan? What kind of form does that take?
Yeah, and I think that that initial risk assessment is crucial in the pre-steps before writing this crisis communications plan. You're going to need that information to write your crisis comms plan. But this document has a few different things. So, you know, the first thing that I typically have clients decide on and come up with when we're putting together a crisis document is deciding on what those guiding values are. With honesty and transparency always being a part of the mix. But kind of just keeping in mind, like, okay, even if something in this sphere of crisis comes up that we haven't planned for, at least we have kind of a foundational set of guidelines that says when we have a crisis going on, we try and make decisions based on these types of qualities and characteristics. We try to always put these things at the forefront of our minds, and we're always going to be as open, honest, and transparent as we could possibly be. Then, in a crisis plan, what we do is really write out what those remaining potential risks are after our risk assessment. Come up with what are those occurrences that may happen that could put my relationship with my different stakeholders that my race has at stake. And I typically divide them into four buckets. Weather, of course, whether it's forecasted or unforecasted, whether it causes discomfort for our participants or if it causes a full cancellation or even just an editing of the course. Safety is another big bucket, right? This could be anything from medical issues to terrorist attacks to death on the course. Even alcohol-related issues at your post-race party. There's also that less than expected experience crisis, right? Where our participant feels like they didn't get what they thought they were going to get. Swag isn't arriving late or it's poor quality. The course was cut, and so they ran 10 miles instead of 13.1. They didn't get photos of them during the event when they thought they were going to get them. There was a really long line at the porta potty. Could be anything, right? But those things that change the actual experience and that impact the expectations that our participants had. And then there's also crises related to our team, right? Because people certainly are a big part of risk. Whether it's a volunteer who accidentally sent people down the wrong street and, you know, gave poor directions, a vendor who maybe said something that offended somebody who was at the expo, a staff member who doesn't handle a customer service related issue with a lot of tact and makes somebody feel uncomfortable or hurt in their response. People are certainly the most unpredictable folks within our group. So we have to think about the crises that come from our team members. But once we have those buckets and once we have an idea of what those different risks are, we make that list. And for every single item on that list, we're going to have a couple of things. We want to break down what our immediate action steps are and what contacts we should activate. So who do we need to call right away when this type of crisis happens? And put their phone number on the page in big red letters so that everybody can see it and find it easily. Do we, even something as simple as, are we immediately calling 911 when this situation happens? It seems silly, but in the crisis moment, you may not be thinking clearly and you may suddenly have your priorities out of whack. So having a quick reminder of even something as basic as call 911, call the race director, whoever those folks are that you need to immediately activate, putting that down on the page as a literal 1-2-3 action step plan. You also need to think about what is your general communication statement going to be about this crisis happening. Now, every single one is going to be nuanced and play out differently, right? But if you can have a skeleton, if you can have a template that at least you have down a reminder of what information you need to put in here, like here I'm going to describe what exactly happened. I'm going to describe what we understand to be the root cause analysis, or even putting in a statement, a boilerplate statement that says, we're currently investigating what the cause of this was, and we expect to have a press conference 24 hours from now to explain it. Whatever that protocol is that you put in place and that you've put into this plan. You're going to address all of those other questions in the holding statement that we talked about. What happened? Why do we think it happened? What did we do to try and keep it from happening? And what are we going to do differently moving forward to make sure it doesn't happen again? And when you're crafting this statement, again, have as much of it there as possible, but always make sure that you're customizing before you share it out. And that's sort of the last piece of each of these crisis plans within the whole crisis communications document is, where does this communication need to go? Is it only going out to your runners? And is it going via email? Is it going via social? Is it only going out to media? Is it going to both? Does it need to go to your vendors? You know, where are you sharing it and who are you sharing it with? And who's responsible for doing that? So does Jonathan need to post on social because he's the social media manager, but Victoria is going to send out the email because she controls our email marketing? You know, or is there someone at Race Command who their whole job for the day is crisis communications and they take ownership of all the channels all at once? But having that breakdown. So again, having the action steps for what you're going to do when a certain crisis happens, the communication or statement that you're planning to put out, at least a skeleton of it, a draft of it that you can adapt in the moment. And then a breakdown of where it's going to be shared, with who, and by who is all going to be a part of each of these crisis plans that you put together. It kind of ends up being a behemoth document in many cases. I've had some that are 50 typed pages long. I've had some that are shorter. But I think that anyone who activates this type of plan is going to find that it's very worthwhile to do because as we no, in the events industry, the unexpected is always around the corner.
Is there a, going back to the bucketing that you suggested of the four different types of crisis, is there some kind of rationale in segmenting crisis along those lines? Is it because, you know, let's say the weather-related stuff would have a different response to it than the race experience stuff, like, you know, like the lost medals and stuff? Is that why you're thinking of why you've categorized it along those four different groups?
Yeah, I think that many of the pieces of information that you're going to share in a statement about, for instance, a medical issue happening on the course or a, you know, some type of other safety threat, somebody drives onto the course with the intention of hurting runners, for example, you're going to have a lot of the same information presented about what you did in advance to mitigate that risk. You know, talking about your EMS teams, your law enforcement teams, about other safety protocol that you had put in place. I think that the reason that I like to bucket them together is that you're going to find that some of the answers are somewhat similar in the information that you present about what you did ahead of time. So that it kind of just makes it easier to keep running through the scenario of like, okay, I have some of this similar information that I need to share, but, you know, there's a nuanced difference between these two crises with the same kind of mitigation plan in front of it. So it just helps you to kind of organize it in your mind. Same with weather. You know, I think that, for example, most race directors are going to say, well, we have a meteorologist that we call. Again, all these things that we're doing to mitigate it ahead of time, who monitors the weather all 7 days leading up to the race. We have a wet bulb that we use. We have these different levels that we decide whether or not we're doing this or that. We met every 2 hours leading up to the race to reassess, et cetera. I think that, you know, again, whether it ends up being a crisis about the race being canceled because of weather or, you know, just having to let runners know that it's going to be a wet day out there and they might not be as comfy as they were going to be on the course before, both are going to require you to share the same mitigation steps that you took. So it just helps with bucketing them together so that you can kind of keep that consistency throughout and reuse some of that same information that you've collected in that section.
Going back to what you said about, you know, like sometimes these things taking 50 pages, obviously most events won't need to get close to that. But also on the other side of this, as a race director, you can also make some common sense decisions around what areas of this to focus on. For instance, you know, if you're in California, if you're in Oregon, which, you know, constantly have issues with wildfires, if you're in Florida, coastal states being hit with hurricanes, you want to focus a little bit more on those kinds of things rather than other. And I'm sure many race directors in those areas may not have a full crisis communications plan, but I'm sure they've thought really hard and probably put something into writing around the kinds of weather-related stuff that they're really prone to be hit with?
Yeah, I think that triaging it is thoughtful. You know, if you have some certain crises that you expect more often than others based on your geographic location, based on the size of your race, the type of event that you do, maybe it's a trail race versus a road race. There's certainly a lot of considerations to make between different distances too, whether you have a 5K or an ultra going on, you've got very different risks, right? But I think that if you don't have a communications team who you can rely on to put one of these crisis documents together and make it completely comprehensive or as comprehensive as possible, it is okay, as you mentioned, to kind of prioritize what crises you expect more often than others and have those available and set the goal that each year, you know, you're going to review these crisis plans that you put together and hopefully add a couple more to your database, to, you know, this toolbox that you're creating so that you're continuing to have a growing document that's living, breathing, and developing as your race is developing.
Yeah, when you were going into the different sort of like event types, I somehow got this flashback from a couple of events in the UK who are triathlons and swim-based events, and they had issues with the quality of the water. I mean, all kinds of things can go wrong, right? I mean, you know, too many algae or bacteria or whatever, and, or like, you know, chemicals in the water. I mean, it's endless in terms of crisis when you're a race director. You do, of course, offer help with all these kinds of things, and I know you're the type of person you're going to be hitting the conference circuit soon in the industry as well as a speaker who likes helping people out. Is there a way that people can perhaps reach out to you if they had some questions about the kinds of things we discussed today or how you might help them with some of these issues?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I love connecting with folks in the race director group that you have on Facebook, Panos. I think it's a wonderful tool for folks to connect with each other. So certainly if there's any discussion around crisis there, I try and offer advice where I can. But yeah, if folks want to learn more about Treat PR and how we might collaborate, you know, we have a variety of different ways that we engage with races, you know, no matter their size or their scope. Our crisis communications planning is a part of our podium package, which is our full service kind of ultra premier PR agency experience for race directors, where for 6 months leading up to their race, we're providing them with full service PR support, everything from press releases to crisis plans to, you know, media training and everything in between. We also have our tempo plans, which are a great document package for races of all sizes to make sure that they're sharing key information points about their race and getting it out there in their local media. We have our online courses. We have a free media training course that anybody can take called Headed for the Headlines that folks can utilize on our website. It's a 1 hour training that will get you prepped for that interview, whether you're hoping to have one soon or you've already secured one. And then we have our PR DIY course for race directors who might be on a limited budget or who want to bootstrap their PR efforts called Headlines and Finish Lines. And that has hours of video, worksheets, cheat sheets, everything you can think of. And we're always adding new content to the course. So it's a one-time investment, but you're going to continue to get new trainings from us that will hopefully benefit you as you drive great mutually beneficial relationships for your race. And then, as you mentioned, yeah, speaking at some upcoming conferences, I'm super active in places like LinkedIn, so I'd love to connect with people there. And if they have questions, they can always simply shoot us a quick email. You can either contact hello@treatpublicrelations.com or you can send one directly to me at meg@treatpublicrelations.com, and I'll be happy to offer you some advice and see if there might be a way for us to support you in good times and in bad, whether it's a crisis situation or a time of celebration for your race.
Indeed. And I should mention that the Headlines and Finish Lines course, which is, as you say, video-based, and it sort of goes a lot further than the very helpful podcast we had on PR and earned media a while back that I would also advise people to go back and check out. That online course is also available at a 30%, very gracious 30% off for our members, for anyone who wants to go through that. And I do think it's a great investment, regardless of whether you take the course or not, for people to invest more on their PR and media. They can really take the feel and the perception and the effectiveness of the race with participants and with the local community to a whole different level. So, hoping for an uneventful 2024 with as few crises to communicate around as possible, I want to thank you very, very much for taking the time today to be with me. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, always a lot of fun to chat with you, Panos, and to be in the world of running. I just feel so lucky that I get to work in this industry every day and talk about races as much as humanly possible. And this is a great space for us to all learn together and connect. So appreciate you having me on and appreciate the community that you've built around this podcast and Race Directors HQ.
Well, thank you very much for all your contributions to the podcast. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to talk about something completely different in the future. Thank you very much for your time again, Meg. It was really helpful. And thanks to everyone listening in. And we'll see you guys on our next podcast. I hope you enjoyed today's episode on Crisis Communications with Meg Treat of Treat Public Relations. You can find more resources on anything and everything related to race directing on our website, racedirectorshq.com. You can also share your thoughts about some of the things discussed in today's episode or anything else in our Facebook group, Race Directors Hub. Many thanks again to our awesome podcast sponsor, RunSignUp, for sponsoring today's episode. And if you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe on your favorite player. And do check out our podcast back catalog for more great content like this. Until our next episode, take care and keep putting on amazing races.